introductions are completed, we will now call our third case today, 00-3037, Thomas Jones versus Secura Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Thomas and Joan Jones is Shane Falk. You may proceed to the podium, and while you're doing that, I have to tell you that the East Wing has been recently renovated, and we have a sound system that doesn't quite operate correctly all the time, with voices fading, so the council may be asked to lower the lectern, raise the lectern, or do other things, and we haven't found out what's the matter, so I don't want you to feel it's your fault or any of the speakers' fault. I've asked the audience to, when they cannot hear, to raise their hands. I think no one has ever raised their hands yet. I know that all of you are not hearing everything, but I think you are concerned that I will call on you if you raise your hand. But again, I make that invitation, you would help us so we have a sense of what's happening. With all that said, Mr. Falk, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Shane W. Falk, and I represent the plaintiffs and the appellants in this action, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Thomas and Joan. Before we start today, I'd welcome the Court's invitation to join the middle school students to learn about the process and discuss it further, but without further ado, this appeal was taken from a declaratory judgment significantly restricting the damages available to Thomas and Joan Jones in their bad faith action. What we're here to determine today is what benefit an insurance company will receive when they commit bad faith, deny an insurance claim, and leave their own insurance hanging out in the wind. Secura argues that where it commits bad faith in adjusting a property loss claim and an insured misfortunately misses the one-year statute of limitation claims, Secura should get a reward. What's this reward? A significant limitation in damages. The prior precedent of this Court and common sense dictates against that result.
Whose responsibility do you think it is when you say miss the date? Well, basically, we're talking about statute of limitations. And I know that, as I understand the facts, that there was a denial, a letter was sent out, and then there was a time period, whatever, and then there was a miss date. Is there a responsibility of the company, or is it the responsibility of your client to notice that date?
First, Mr. and Mrs. Jones met their responsibility. There is a burden on their part to meet the statute of limitations, and they have. There's a two-year statute of limitations for the tort claim of bad faith, and they've met that limitations. The tort claim of bad faith is a concurrent claim with the breach of contract claim. A breach of contract and the tort of bad faith results from one occurrence, a denial of policy benefits. In addition, though, there's also a burden, according to the Jones, that the insurance company could have informed them that there's a one-year statute of limitations. And it's important to note that the adjuster in this case came out to the home, spent 10 or 15 minutes at the home, closed the file the same day, denied the claim, and summarily discharged the Joneses' claim. So the Joneses have met their burden with respect to the two-year statute of limitations. They did miss the one-year, but arguably it's a concurrent claim anyway. Starting with the analysis of the facts here now that Your Honor has raised them, it's important to note that the Joneses brought this property, a combination motel and residence, in 1985. They insured the property with a different insurance company, Secura, in 1993. Paid their premiums faithfully every single year. Then, in 1996, when heavy construction occurred down the road from their property, The highway was rerouted past their property, and significant vehicle traffic was going within 5 to 10 feet of their foundation walls. They had a collapse of a large portion of the home. They presented a claim in April of 1997. May of 1997, the claim, as I just described, was summarily denied. Following the denial of that claim, the Joneses were unable to repair their home, their business, lost it through bankruptcy, and the property was foreclosed upon by the bank. The Joneses have suffered damages. Before we even get to discussing whether they're contract damages or tort damages, they suffered damages. The damages are the lost use of the property, the lost business, the bankruptcy, emotional distress, attorney fees in pursuing the claim, punitive damages. These are all damages suffered by the Joneses. Secure's breach of contract and their breach of the fiduciary duty to the Joneses as their insured result from the same occurrence. The May 1997 denial of their policy claim without an adequate investigation. The Joneses are entitled to present two separate and distinct claims or theories of recovery as a result of that breach. One is in contract and one is in tort. The breach of contract claim is limited by the terms of the contract, the damages that it prescribes, plus consequential damages. But the tort claim is not so limited. General tort principles mandate that as a damage for a tort, an insured or a plaintiff is entitled to all damages or any damages as a proximate result of that tort. And here the tort was a bad faith denial of the claim, which coincidentally is concurrent with the breach of the contract.
Is there any reason, counsel, under your argument for a plaintiff to ever bring a breach of contract claim? Seems to me it would be meaningless. You just bring your tort of bad faith and don't bother bringing a breach of contract claim.
Trust me, it would have been a lot easier to bring the breach of contract claim. As we all know, the burden for a breach of contract claim is far less than proving an intentional tort, a bad faith, unreasonable debate, or a reasonable debate as to whether the policy covers it. It's a lot easier to present the breach of contract claim. So there's a big incentive for plaintiffs to meet that. Certainly, the legislature, I believe, was misconceived when they passed a one-year statute of limitations and property loss claims for breach of contract actions that normally have a six-year statute of limitations. The purpose behind the one-year statute was so that insurance companies could fairly and adequately adjust the claim. They had notice here a month before they denied the claim, well within the 1 year, never investigated it, never adjusted it fairly, and never paid on the claim. So certainly the breach of contract is a much easier way to go, and the Joneses concede they wish they still had that claim. Unfortunately, due to missed opportunities, they didn't get to present it. The tort of bad faith is very unique. It's troubling for many people to understand what this claim is. I'm going to try and simplify it the way that it should be understood. It's not a tortious breach of contract. It's not a breach of contract. It's not based on the policy. Now, Respondent Secura has cited many cases from across the United States that apply a one-year statute of limitations. Nearly every one of those cases bases that on the fact that that tort of bad faith is a contractual claim. It's based on the policy. This very court decided in Warmka that that wasn't going to happen in Wisconsin. It's a separate and independent tort. It's not based on the policy. It's based upon a common law fiduciary duty of good faith and fair dealing that exists separate and apart from the obligations of the contract. Yes, it's a unique nature of a tort because there's a contract involved. The contract creates the underlying obligation initially, but this court recognized in Anderson versus Continental Insurance Company and DeChant that this is the key element in justifying the use of tort remedies in a bad faith claim. The fact that it's based on this common law, independent breach of fiduciary duty.
And and the insured, the Joneses in this case, let's assume that they had brought, that there wasn't a statute of limitations problem. Could they recover their damages in breach of contract as well and then recover duplicative damages?
No. And obviously that's an issue that has been raised in the Court of Appeals decision in Hayden, and I believe in Secura's brief they misquote the case or misunderstand the case. There was a viable contract claim there until judgment was passed. And the issue in the bad faith claim, after judgment was entered and award was given on the breach of contract, the issue on the tort case for bad faith was whether or not they could recover those same damages. The Court of Appeals did not determine that issue. They left it to the trier of fact to determine it. So the bottom line is, as the Joneses have maintained from the beginning, we're dealing with concurrent theories of liability. Damages available on both may be concurrent to both, but since the contract claim is gone, we don't have to worry about duplicative theories of recovery. We don't have to worry about the plaintiffs being unjustly enriched in this situation. If both were viable, we could proceed with the breach of contract claim, get our award under that, but we'd need a special verdict instruction separate from that with regard to the bad faith damages and a clarifying instruction with respect to the fact that we can't award the same damages for both.
Mr. Falk, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute. It's my understanding that Wisconsin's adoption of the idea of bad faith was considered to be a somewhat narrow adoption, at least in comparison with California and some other states. Where does the narrowness fit in? Does it fit in regard to damages, or why are we characterized as having a narrow doctrine?
Secura misapplies this belief that there's a narrow doctrine of bad faith in Wisconsin. It's based on the claim of bad faith. To establish a claim of bad faith, we have the burden of proving intent, which California and some of the other cases do not require. That is tougher, but Wisconsin is more expansive than California and every single other out-of-state case that Secura cited because of one key thing. Warka said that bad faith is separate and independent from the contractual claim. It's not based on the contract. If you look closely at all the cases, the 16 cases cited by the Secura in their brief, every single one of those established the exact opposite holding, that the one-year statute of limitation applies because it's based on the policy. The bad faith claim is relegated to a contractual claim in those states. So I would say, and the Joneses firmly believe, that Wisconsin is actually much more expansive and much more enlightened than any of the other states cited by Secura.
Well, don't we have some somewhat inconsistent language, for instance, in cases like DeShant versus Monarch Life, where on one hand we're talking about damages ought to be obtainable for the proximate result of the bad faith, and then later on we seem to use language that limits what the recovery could be. How do you reconcile that language?
Whenever there's been a limit on what the recovery has been, there's been a viable contract claim, and there's been a fear that there'd be a duplicative recovery. We don't have that here. This case is a case of first impression, unfortunately. The Warnke decision doesn't specify, once the court allowed the bad faith claim to proceed forward despite the contract case being dismissed, it doesn't prescribe specifically what the damages are. But it's clear from DeChamp, from Anderson, from your recent decisions in Danner and such, that the damages are the general tort damages. And those damages are any damages proximately resulting from the tort of bad faith. Now, furthermore, DeChamp as well as Anderson clarify that the purpose of bad faith is to protect the insured and to provide redress for all economic harms. If this court does not recognize all the tort damages available to the Joneses, regardless of whether they're concurrent with a breach of contract or not, there are going to be substantial on the compensable harms left in this case and the theory of bad faith or the protective nature of a bad faith claim will be eviscerated. In Warmka, this court made clear that the difference between a contract claim on the policy and the bad faith tort claim creates a difference in statute of limitations. This one-year statute of limitations is secure, tries to assert in this case, is trying to circumvent this court's precedent from Warmka. They didn't appeal the two-year statute of limitations. They didn't appeal the fact that Wisconsin finds that the tort of bad faith is separate and independent from the insurance contract. And they can't reverse those issues at this point. Those have been decided, well-settled facts of law. Now,
could I ask you a question? Are you familiar with the economic loss doctrine?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that in any way influence how we should look at this case?
No, because the tort damages allow us any damages proximately resulting from the bad faith. And I keep reemphasizing that. But the point is, under this situation with the Jones, they denied the claim. Secure denied the claim. If they had adjusted the claim fairly and paid it fairly, they could have repaired their home. They would have had no damages. As a result of that denial of the claim, not only did they suffer the lost home, the repair costs, the bankruptcy and things like that, they've suffered things that are extra contractual. Tort remedies, of course, provide you much more than just economic damages. So we have the economic damages that happen to be concurrent with some of the things that the insurance contract covered. It's interesting here, the hypocrisy of Secure's argument, because what they try to do at summary judgment, of course, is prove that there was no insurance coverage. And now, on the other hand, they're saying, well, wait a minute, all these damages are covered by insurance, so we don't have to pay them. That shows that they're attempting to create a safe haven for bad faith. It's unique to property loss claims. You're probably going to have bad faith claims coming up more often in these situations because of the short one-year statute of limitations on the contract than you will in other cases where there's a six-year. So it's imperative that this court recognize the serious nature of this case. There are other instances in Wisconsin law where you will have concurrent theories of liability. For instance, let's assume you were punched in the nose at a bar. You have a negligent claim against the person who inflicted the injury. You also have an intentional tort claim. Say you filed the suit 2.5 years after the injury happens. The judge rightfully will dismiss the intentional tort claim because the statute of limitations of 2 years has expired. But you still have the negligence claim. Just because that intentional tort claim was dismissed doesn't mean some of your damages are dismissed. You're still able to recover all your damages in the negligence claim. This court should follow its decision in Duchamp, recognizing that we have a separate theory, a separate independent claim for bad faith in Wisconsin based on tort principles. Follow the reasoning further spelled out in the Oklahoma case, Taylor versus State Farm, and also the Utah case, which happens to conflict with some of the case law cited by Secura, that indicates when you've got a tort that's independent of the contract, you've got to give the plaintiff all their damages.
Counsel, your opposing counsel suggests that what you're attempting to do is transparent. That the statute of limitations on contract is blown. And now they would suggest that you're attempting to put, trying to fit damages where they do not fit. What can you say to make the lens of the court disagree with that perspective?
First,
abuse the court of that perspective.
First, you don't define the damages by the damages alone. You define the damages by the claim. You start with what your theory of recovery is. Theory of recovery for breach of contract. You have a theory of recovery for the tort of bad faith. Any damages subject to that tort of bad faith are tort damages, regardless of whether they're contract damages under the breach of contract claim. It's a statement to say just because you can label some damages breach of contract because they fit under the breach of contract, it automatically removes them from the tort of bad faith and their subsequent damages. You look to the good case law that Securus cited with regard to breach of contract. Breach of contract, you get the contract terms that were violated, plus you get consequential damages. That's what you get, that's all. Tort, you get any damages proximately resulting from that tort. And here it will include the economic losses, all of them, that the Joneses suffered, plus things like emotional distress, attorney fees, and under allied processors by the Court of Appeals, even expert fees that aren't normally included in cases such as these. So what benefits should Securus receive for bad faith? Wisconsin law dictates that Securus should not receive a benefit for committing bad faith. Bad faith was created by this court in Anderson versus Continental Insurance Company to protect insurance, to even the disparity in negotiating between insurance and insurers. We have a big problem with property loss claims because of this significantly limiting one-year statute of limitations. Nobody's circumventing any statute of limitations. Unfortunately, the Joneses missed out on a much easier case, but they can still get those damages under the tort claim as tort damages if they prove the intentional factor associated with bad faith claims. The court has been correct and should remain correct with repeatedly affirming the separate nature of the theory of bad faith. Securus attempts to argue that once you establish a contract damage, it's forever a contract damage, and that damage never changes. Unfortunately, since we recognize that the tort of bad faith is an independent tort, some of those damages that appear to be contract can also be tort damages. Is it confusing? Perhaps. But that's what the unique nature of a separate independent tort claim is. If you look to those other decisions cited by Securus from out of state, every one of them says, wait a minute, we're not going to be confused by this. This is a contractual claim. It's based on the policy. We're going to apply the one-year statute of limitations. It's wrong. And Wisconsin recognized that and adopted in Warmka the separate and independent nature and the two-year statute of limitations for the tort claim.
Do we have to withdraw all the language in the cases that refer to these damages as being unrelated to contract damages? Clarify that language.
If you read Poling and Hayden, if that's what you're referring to, very carefully, and look at what they're talking about, they're talking about emotional distress. The Joneses concede to get emotional distress in a tort of bad faith claim, you've got to prove more than just the breach of contract damages. You need substantial damages above and beyond the contract.
I'm familiar with that part of the doctrine. What I'm referring to more prominently is the language in the Duchant case, which has been referred to earlier from the bench, but there is clear language in that case which discusses the tort of bad faith and the theory of the tort of bad faith, and the language includes statements about how it is that it exists for the recovery of damages unrelated to contract damages. It also discusses in broader language about the damages being recoverable if they are proximately caused by the breach. But there is language that is conflicting, and that's what the Court of Appeals noted, and that's why the Court of Appeals certified the case to us, I believe.
Well,
so do we have to withdraw that language?
No. And I think the Court of Appeals misinterpreted that provision. Again, they're being confused by Securus' argument from Poling and Hayden, which misinterpreted the issues surrounding emotional distress. If you read the entire paragraph that you're referring to, you start out with, by virtue of the relationship between the parties created by the insurance contract, a special duty arises, the breach of which duty is a tort unrelated to contract damages. All the court was pointing out to Chant is that you have two separate theories of recovery. It doesn't mean you have different damages. If you look back to Anderson, the specific language that everybody looks to when they rely on Anderson is the language discussing the fact that when you have a bad faith claim, you recover for breach of contract, and bad faith damages, and they're dealing with the damages under the contract and bad faith. They don't say different from the bad faith damages. They don't say or bad faith damages. When you have a bad faith claim, you can recover from one or both, or in this case, unfortunately, we're left with just one. So no, it's a separate claim. They're talking about separate claims. The damages are unrelated because one is based on theories of contract, one is based on theories of tort.
Well, isn't it more accurate to say that, and this is how I understand your position, it's not that the damages are unrelated, it's that the damages overlap. And as I understand your position, you're saying just because the damages overlap doesn't mean that they are extinguished when one of the claims is extinguished by virtue of a statute of limitations being dismissed. That's how I understand your argument.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So why not?
Why not change why
shouldn't, when that claim is extinguished by virtue of the statute of limitations expiring, those damages also go too?
Because the Joneses aren't claiming contract damages. They're claiming tort damages. It's as simple as that.
Well, you want the policy. You want recovery under the policy.
No. We want recovery on the bad faith claim of tort, which is separate and independent.
Well, that's what you're calling it, but you want the policy proceeds, right?
No. We want the home repaired. We want the home value returned to us. And, oh, by the way, had they repaired the home in the first place, we could have had that under the contract as well.
Okay. Well, let's say the home repair exceeds the amount of... Are you entitled to recover it?
Under the tort of bad faith, we get the whole amount. If the contract claim was still viable, under the tort of bad faith, we would get the contract amount plus the excess amount if they improperly adjusted the claim.
So the limitations in the policy have no application in a bad faith claim, and I understand I'm not talking about the collateral damages of lost profits or, not lost profits, but the collateral damages of emotional distress, etc. So the policy limits have nothing to do with it.
1-year statute of limitation has nothing to do with the tort of bad faith, correct? And those overlapping damages that also can be claimed concurrently under the breach of contract are not distinguished simply because the breach is gone. Breach of contract is gone because of the 1-year statute of limitations. That's correct. It's a simple way to analyze it. It's clear if you look to the claim first before you start discussing the type of damages. You look to the claim, you have tort, you have breach of contract. One is based on tort theories. One is based on contract theories. There are some damages available under contract, some available under tort. At that point, you may have overlapping damages, but just because the contract's gone doesn't mean that you lose the tort damages. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kobach, representing Secure Insurance Company.
Court. My name is Attorney Todd Joseph Kobach, and I am here today representing the defendant and the respondent in this matter, Secure Insurance and Mutual Company. It's interesting that today is a cloudy and gray day because that's precisely the type of gray thing that we have before us today. The Wisconsin legislature has adopted Wisconsin statute section number 631.83, which has subsection number 1 that says the statute of limitations or a claim on an insurance policy is 1 year or 12 months, as it says in the statute. A subsequent Wisconsin legislature statute, 893.05, says that when a statute of limitations expires, that extinguishes not only the right, but the remedy. However, on the other hand, this court has said in the case of Warmka versus Heartland Cicero Mutual Insurance that the tort of bad faith is an intentional tort, and it's not governed by the 1-year statute of limitations for a contract, but it's governed by a 2-year statute of limitations for intentional torts, also found in a statute. Now, as Attorney Falk has pointed out, a number of courts have dealt with cases where there are valid breach of contract claims and there are valid bad faith tort claims. And they have dealt with the damage issues in those cases. Some of the cases this court has dealt with is DeChant. And the Court of Appeals, lower courts of appeals, have dealt with the same issues in cases like Poling and Hayden, which are also have been briefed. However, the gray area that brings us here today is what the Court of Appeals, District 3, has submitted to this court for resolution. Do bad faith tort damages generally include damages that also could have been pursued on the breach of contract claim, mainly policy benefits? And if yes, what effect would the statute of limitations on the breach of contract claim have on that recovery? Secura's position today before the court is that a line of precedent since this court's decision in Anderson versus Continental Insurance Company, all the way up to the recent case this year of Danner versus Auto Owners Mutual Insurance, recognizes that the damages that you can recover on a bad faith tort are unrelated and they're separate and they're distinct from the type of damages you can recover on contract action.
What do you do with this problem, as I perceive it, that argue Champ, for instance, you just did, that it says it's unrelated. You read a few lines later and it says all the damages that are the proximate result. And that's true of Danner, too. Including paragraph in Danner, citing DeChant, says the same thing. So don't you and your opposing counsel have, at best, cases that can be interpreted either way?
I think yes and no. If you take the one line that says all proximate damage caused by the tort of bad faith can be recovered, if you pull that out of context, then yes, then you can recover all the damages Attorney Falk would like to recover for his clients in this case. If you put that sentence back into the context of the case where you talk about quote unquote unrelated damages, separate and distinct damages, and language also in the chant that says that tort damages are those that can be recovered, but for the tort of bad faith. When you start looking at all the language and putting it into the context, I think you start to realize that the tort of bad faith, as Attorney Falk recognizes, is unique in that the breach of contract exists to recover policy benefits, but there's also the additional bad faith tort that's there to compensate whatever additional damages the breach of contract claim doesn't recover.
Is there any other tort claim, whether it be an intentional tort or a straight tort claim, any other tort claim that does not have damages that are the proximate result of that claim?
If I understand the way you're asking the question, you're asking me, maybe if you could rephrase it for me so I can get a better sense.
Yeah, I think I inartfully phrased it. Let me try that again. Whether it be the run-of-the-mill tort claim or any other intentional tort claim, I'm going to advance the position that by the very nature of a tort claim, damages for a tort claim under Wisconsin law are damages which are the proximate result of the conduct or the injury or the incident. You're telling me, seems to me, that may be true for every other tort claim, for every other intentional tort claim, but it's not true for the intentional tort claim that we have here. We're going to take that standard rule, the damages are the proximate result of the injury or negligence. And we're going to limit the damages in this particular type of intentional tort. And my question to you Is there any other tort claim which says we're going to eschew, I like that word, the, sounds like I have a cold, doesn't it? We're going to get rid of the normal rule that you're in tort, you're entitled to damages which are the proximate result, and we're going to limit those damages. Any other type of tort claim?
I don't think so, and the reason I say that is maybe if I could provide a sort of illustration, I know it helps me understand it, maybe it'll help you. Dan Falk's correct when he says the bad faith tort claim is unique. And the reason it's unique is because every time you have a bad faith tort claim, you necessarily have a breach of contract. And the reason I say that is, maybe I can do this by way of hand gestures. If you're bringing a breach of contract claim, to oversimplify it, basically you're saying that the insurance company denied policy benefits when they shouldn't have. You're basically saying if you can show the breach, you're entitled to a recovery of policy benefits. However, that's the one hand. On the other hand, we have a bad faith tort claim. Now, every contract gives rise to an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. Now, what do we have to prove to show bad faith tort? Well, this court has said in Anderson that first, you have to show the absence of a reasonable basis for denying benefits of the policy. Now, if we break that language apart, the end part says denying benefits of the policy, which means you have to show a breach of the contract. You denied the policy benefits, there's a breach. The first part of that says you have to show an absence of a reasonable basis, meaning no reasonable person could find a good reason why you should deny those benefits. In other words, the first prong of Anderson says you have to basically show the court that you're entitled to a directed verdict on a breach of contract.
What do you do with the Warmka language that seems to, Justice Steinmetz wrote that opinion, that seems to disentangle the tort of bad faith from the contract action and to emphasize that it's based on a common law duty and not a contractual duty? Now, I know that's an issue where there's disagreement here, but I'm asking you to respond to the Warmka discussion that does that.
I think Warmka is correct because, like I said, every insurance contract is going to have an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. That's something that comes with every contract. And I think for that reason, the Warmka decision was correct in saying you have a common law tort for the breach of that implied duty. I think the stickier problem or the stickier situation you run into is the Anderson decision, which says that one of the elements you're going to have to show for a bad faith tort is the breach of contract. And you're not going to have to just show a standard breach of contract. You're going to have to show that there's no reasonable basis why those policy benefits were not provided. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm still having some trouble, and I'm looking at the Warmka language that cites the Davis case that says, you know, we emphasize at this juncture only that the tort of bad faith is not a tortuous breach of contract. And well, you seem to be arguing that in essence it is.
Sorry. I don't think it is, in essence, a tortious breach of contract. It's a breach of the implied duty that accompanies the contract. You have the contract, and if you breach that, there's your contract claim, there's your contract damages. However, the contract itself has this implied duty, like a tort, where I owe a reasonable duty of care to you. If I breach that, there's a tort. If you breach this implied duty that comes with the contract, you have the tort. It's not a contract. But the way that Anderson has described it, you have to show first that there is a breach of the contract, that those policy limits were denied. And second, you have to show an intent element, which I think is very important because it's that additional intent element that entitles you to additional damages beyond your policy benefits, your contract damages. It entitles you to things like emotional distress damages, attorney's fees, things that you wouldn't get on the breach of contract by itself, but things that you do get because you can show additionally that there's a clear breach of contract and also that there's an intent element. I'm try not to dance around the issue, but I hope that addresses your question. Would the court like a brief recitation from the facts by me, or are they satisfied with the Attorney Falk's recitation?
Could I ask, does the economic loss doctrine play any part of our consideration here?
Well, I'm probably not as familiar with the economic loss doctrine as Attorney Falk. From my understanding of it, I don't think it is relevant to the issues that we have here. Just for clarification purposes, I believe that it's important for this court to know that this is not a final judgment appeal. It is an interlocutory appeal. Attorney Falk has represented a number of facts to you that were also briefed to the trial court and to the Court of Appeals and also submitted in the form of affidavit. However, there hasn't been substantial discovery in this case. So when Attorney Falk says to you that he may be able to prove bad faith damages and he's entitled to this and he's entitled to that, there's going to be a serious question at this point right now in the litigation whether he will even be able to prove bad faith. And I want the court to be at least aware. I think it's important, before we discuss DeChant and Taylor and some of the other cases that were briefed, to look at what the consequences of the appellant's position will be in this litigation. The appellants talk about their appeal to this court to expand the bad faith remedies, to take the stance they have taken and broaden it, and to take the lead in the nation in showing that bad faith on the part of the insurance company should have some remedy for the insured. Now, while I would agree that this court should take an expansive role in bad faith, I don't think what the appellants are arguing does that in this case. And the reason I say that is because if my insurance company acts in bad faith towards me and I would like to bring a bad faith claim against them, if I bring it in a timely manner, the court's decision today will not affect me. It will not affect the diligent insured who brings a bad faith and a breach of contract claim and pursues it in a timely manner. The court's decision today, if they find for the appellant, will affect the insured who isn't diligent, who's not timely, who sits on their claim for over a year, then realizes, hey, maybe I should bring a lawsuit for this, and they miss the statute of limitations. The court's decision will also affect attorneys who commit malpractice, who looked up the wrong statute of limitations and realized, oh my goodness, I missed the one-year statute of limitations. I should try and revive this with a bad faith claim because I have 2 years for that. This court is not going to be expanding the remedies for insurance with respect to bad faith. What it's going to be doing is, if it finds for the appellants, is providing a safe haven for those attorneys who make a mistake, for those insureds who don't act diligently and who don't bring timely claims. It's basically a saving grace for those people. So I think that the appellant's position is incorrect when they say that they're asking the court to expand bad faith remedies. They're not doing that. They're asking you to bail some of those insureds out. I think it's important also to address the Chant decision, which some of the justices have already asked about. The language in the Chant was pretty clear when it noted a difference between a breach of contract and bad faith. It talked about the tort of bad faith as being a separate intentional wrong, creating damages unrelated to contract damages. They also cited a commentary by Lawrence D. Rose, which said, bad faith actions allow an insured to recover extra contractual damages. In that same decision, the court said that those extra contractual damages and bad faith tort damages would include attorney's fees and bond premiums. I think that the DeChant decision, when the language is looked at whole, clarifies that the breach of contract claim in this case and the policy benefits that you could recover on that claim are unrelated and separate and distinct from those that could be recovered on the tort of bad faith. As I've already stated to the court, there is a statute of limitations of 1 year on the breach of contract claim, and there's also a subsequent Wisconsin legislative statute which says if a statute of limitations runs, that extinguishes not only the right the right to recovery on a breach of contract claim, but it also extinguishes the remedy, which would be the pursuit of policy benefits and other consequential damages. Contract. And I think that's important. The chant also uses the language that damages for the tort of bad faith are those that would not have been incurred but for the tort of bad faith. And I think that language is also important because if you look at a claim for emotional distress damages would not be incurred but for the tort of bad faith, because you can't recover emotional distress on the contract if you breach an insurance contract. It would only be recovered on the tort. However, let's take extra contractual, or I'm sorry, emotional distress damages out of that sentence, and let's put in policy benefits. Policy benefits, I'm sorry, you cannot recover policy benefits that would not have been incurred but for the bad faith. Now that doesn't make sense, because you would have been able to recover the policy benefits on the breach of contract claim.
Counsel, in preparing for oral arguments, I have a couple of tools that I often like to use. One tool is the jury instruction manuals. And when I'm dealing with a damage question, I like the treatise from the Law of Damages in Wisconsin, because it's a treatise that deals with Wisconsin damages. I look at the jury instruction 2761, bad faith by insurance company, assured's claim. And I look at the comment and its interpretation of the chant. Now, I start with a caveat that the jury instruction, of course, and their comments are not law. The law of damages isn't necessarily the law, but I use these as helpful tools. It interprets to chant, I think, like your, well, it says the tort of bad faith is a separate intentional wrong which results from a breach of duty imposed as a consequence of the relationship established by contract, citing to chant 569. When such a breach occurs, the insurer is liable for any damages are the result of that breach. Likewise, in the Law of Damages in Wisconsin, under, and I didn't bring the book out, I just photocopied part of it. Under bad faith, first party cases, the very first sentence, which is its own paragraph, states, in first party bad faith cases, the insured may recover the benefits under the policy and the consequential damage is naturally flowing from the tort, and it cites the case of Davis, which is also the case relied upon in Warmka. Your position is contrary to both of those, is that correct?
That's correct.
Are you at all familiar with the Davis case that's cited in Warmka too?
I reviewed it, and if I remember correctly, it was not dispositive to the direct issue we had today, which, of course, most of the cases we have aren't.
Yes, if it were, maybe we wouldn't be here. Okay.
I guess the way I would address that is my understanding of Anderson, DeChance, and the language that has come from the Court of Appeals on this issue has consistently recognized the unrelated term. It's consistently said that bad faith damages, tort damages, if you will, and contract damages are separate. They're distinct. There's no relation between the two. And I think that makes sense when you remember that in order to prove bad faith, you have to prove there's a breach of contract. So necessarily, every time you're bringing a bad faith tort claim, you're going to have a bad faith, or I'm sorry, a breach of contract claim. And whether you bring it timely is a different issue entirely. But I think it's important to know that just the elements of proof. Faith, you have to show the breach of contract as well. And I think when you put that formula together with the language that this court and the Court of Appeals have adopted, then the quote-unquote unrelated language makes sense. The separate and distinct language makes sense. Because when you bring your bad faith claim, you've got your policy benefits you can recover on the breach of contract, and you have the additional damages. Anything else, all proximate damages after that, that you can recover on the bad faith tort. Did I answer your question?
Thank you.
One thing I would like to address is the appellants have submitted a case, Taylor versus State Farm Fire and Casualty Company, which is an Oklahoma case, a 1999 case. Basically, they've attempted to analogize the facts of the case and ask this court to do what the Taylor court did, and that's basically overlook the fact that the breach of contract claim has been dismissed, and in the course of two paragraphs said you can still recover the policy benefits on the tort claim. I don't think that this court should be guided by the Taylor decision, and I say that for three reasons. For one, it's an Oklahoma case, and that's important because Oklahoma's position on bad faith is much broader than Wisconsin's. Oklahoma is one of the few states in this nation that has strictly adopted the Grunberg standard from California. Under the Grunberg analysis, an insurer that wants to prove bad faith doesn't have to prove intent on the part of the insurance company. What they only have to show is that the insurer unreasonably interpreted the insurance contract. That's a fairly broad standard, and I'm sure that California gets a lot of bad faith claims using that language. And as I pointed out, Oklahoma is one of the few states in the nation that has adopted that broad standard for bad faith. And for that reason, I think that this court should be wary of the fact that when Anderson was decided by this court, Attorney Falk recognizes that an additional element of intent was required by this court. You can't just show that there's an unreasonable interpretation of the insurance contract. You have to show that the defendant knew or reasonably disregarded a lack of a reasonable basis for denying the claim, an intent element. And I think the court wisely restricted and refined what bad faith is rather than leaving it an open book to bring whatever claims you wish. And for that reason, I think the Taylor court's decision on this, while it's actually similar, I don't think the reasoning and the policies behind it are instructive in guiding this court with respect to this case. Another reason I don't think Taylor is persuasive in deciding this issue is because it's one of a few court cases in a few states that actually would allow this type of recovery. I believe the appellants have alluded to the numerous cases in the respondent's brief from other jurisdictions. Some of those cases are, as Attorney Falk has represented, cases where the courts have said the bad faith tort is a tort on the policy. So therefore, if you have a statute of limitations that governs the insurance policy, it also applies to the tort of bad faith. Now, we know that's not the law in Wisconsin because of Warmka. And I recognize that. I'm not arguing to you today that it's otherwise. There's some other states in the nation, I believe five or six of them cited in the respondent's brief, that treat bad faith not as a tort action, but as a contract action. And on the contract action, bad faith will entitle you to extra contractual damages. But again, if you have a statute of limitations that governs the insurance policy, that also wipes away the bad faith if you miss it. And then there's four or five states that actually do not allow a recovery for bad faith. Now, I would agree with the appellant's argument that Wisconsin does not treat bad faith or has not treated bad faith in the same way that these other cases have. And I am not arguing to the court that they should adopt the reasoning of another court when it clearly differs from this court's decision in Warmka and the subsequent case law. What I am using these cases for is to point out to the court that no matter what sort of logic or tests or analyses you use for bad faith, there are still a large number of cases and a large number of states that are not going to allow the particular remedy the appellants are seeking. Whether you use this court's opinion in Warmka, where they say you have a 2-year statute of limitations for bad faith, and that that doesn't, that the statute of limitations for the contracts don't foreclose that. While other states that I've cited do not use that reasoning, they make it clear that if you lose the contract action or you don't bring a timely contract action, you can't turn around and bring a bad faith claim to revive the lost damages. And I think it's important for the court not to look at these other cases that are cited for some sort of reasoning or to follow their rules or to change Wisconsin's rules with respect to statute of limitations and things like that. I think they should be guided by the fact that these other states do not allow the remedy that the appellants are seeking.
So what is the measure of damages then? And what items of damages are recoverable? If not the policy proceeds and any other consequentials that would be recoverable in the contract action?
In the situation where a breach of contract claim has either not been brought or it's expired by virtue of the statute of limitations.
What's the measure?
I believe the measure of damages for the bad faith would be the other things that this court and the Court of Appeals have allowed. Attorney's fees for bringing a bad faith claim, bond premiums if the case, the facts of the case allow that. I believe there are case law that says you can recover interest on the damages. Punitive damages, obviously, which wouldn't be recovered in the breach of contract claim. Emotional distress, which wouldn't be recovered in the contract claim. It would be, from my understanding and the way that I look at Wisconsin's case law and the reasoning of other states, it would be those damages excluding contract damages, excluding policy benefits. Anything else that's proximately caused by the tort arguably is fair game, but it would not include policy benefits, which are dismissed pursuant to the statute of limitations or not brought, if that's the case.
So here that excludes anything related to the property loss?
If it's covered by the policy, I think that would be something that should have been brought in a breach of contract claim. If you haven't either timely filed the claim or brought the claim to recover what would have been recoverable under the policy, I think you foreclosed the avenue of recovering what we've been terming policy benefits, which would be property loss, things that would have been covered. And I think the reasoning for that is because I don't think it's appropriate to provide some sort of reward, again, for insureds that sit on their stale claims or sit on debt.
Sure, I understand. Your position is that this circumvents the statute of limitations and allows a plaintiff to resurrect a cause of action, essentially, or damages stemming from a cause of action which has been extinguished by operation of the statute of limitations.
That's correct.
But doesn't that just take the guts out of the damages in the bad faith tort?
Not if you're a diligent insured or a practicing attorney that can file a timely breach of contract claim. I think the I'm sorry.
But this rule is a rule that's going to apply to all tort of bad faith.
That's
cases.
Correct.
And I understand that in most cases the claims are brought together and there isn't this problem of statute of limitations. That's an unusual circumstance. But, I mean, it seems to me that that does take the heart out of the damages for the tort.
Well, I think that would be appropriate given the fact that if you wanted to recover the policy benefits, there's a 1-year statute of limitations. You could brought a timely claim. If you didn't timely bring that claim or you missed it, I don't think you should be allowed to revive what you've overlooked. Does that make sense or no? I think it's not a penalty that we're asking the court to impose. We're asking the court to acknowledge that there's a statute of limitations that covered the breach of contract damages.
Right. You're asking to be left in the procedurally beneficial position that you now occupy with this expiration of the statute of limitations.
Correct to some extent. Perhaps not my choice of words, but that's about the point. And I think that doesn't differ from any other statute of limitations. If you have a negligence claim and you miss the statute of limitations, I don't believe there's going to be a court that's going to allow you to somehow revive those in some other guise just because it feels sympathetic to you and thinks that you should be able to get a little bit more damages.
Thank you.
thing I do want to address before my time is up is a matter we have breached. A matter that we have briefed. The appellants have consistently argued that there's a strong policy favoring bad faith remedies and expanding that. I point out to the court that in our brief, there has been a growing concern nationwide that bad faith has gone too far, that plaintiffs' attorneys are basically using it as leverage, filing bad faith claims whenever they have the chance, simply to get insurance companies to settle, to bargain for higher amounts, to defend claims that they shouldn't have to defend. I think this court should take the lead, as it did in Anderson, Warmka, and subsequent cases, and put limits on the bad faith tort, or not put limits on, but refine and define the limits that already are existing, but perhaps aren't clear in the case law. I think that's especially important, given that this growing concern in the nation is that insurance companies are being put on the hook for claims that they shouldn't be on the hook for. Insurance companies spend a lot of time and energy processing a lot of claims daily. And for the one or two times that you're going to have a bad faith claim, I think they do a remarkably good job of processing claims in a fair manner. I don't think that they should have to face an exposure to a bad faith claim in every single action where something is not done exactly the way the insured wants it.
Is there any empirical evidence to support that, or is that just anecdotal on your part?
I believe there's some commentary and there's some court justices. There's some empirical evidence cited in some of the commentary that I did submit in the brief that basically says this amount of bad faith claims have been brought since X year increases in numbers in terms of showing the increases in numbers over the past few years.
Any statistics about how many of those are defense verdicts as opposed to plaintiff's verdicts and size of verdicts, et cetera?
I don't believe, as I sit here and give you a recollection, that there is any indication in those materials. And I see that my time is up, so are there any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Gobet. Mr. Falk, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Not all bad faith claims also have a concurrent breach of contract claim. The Danner decision is a perfect example. Auto owners paid their limits. They took too long, the adjusters adjusted the claim unfairly, and they were hit with bad faith. You don't always have a breach of contract associated with a bad faith claim. They're separate and independent. The reason why there's unrelated damage is because one's based on tort, one's based on contract. It's generous of Secura to say that as long as we bring the claim within 1 year, we can have our damages. But they've got to remember, Secura must remember, that there's a 2-year statute of limitations. We've met the statute of limitations. We're entitled to every damage as a proximate result of that bad faith. The facts that were cited in our brief is to emphasize the importance of this case. It isn't an unregular occurrence. Warmka was exactly the same situation. The breach of contract claim was dismissed. The case was appealed because the trial court had applied the 1-year statute of limitations to the bad faith claim. On appeal, the Supreme Court said 2-year statute of limitations, it's viable. It happens. They cited an Oklahoma case that applies the exact same reasoning that this court should adopt, as well as the Utah case. The Crookston case clearly points out, even though they recognize bad faith as a contractual claim, the tort of fraud, you know, creative plaintiff's attorney, tort of fraud, is separate. And you get all the damages, even though in Crookston, the breach of contract claim had expired.
But in that instance, wouldn't the economic loss doctrine?
Excuse me?
In that instance, wouldn't the economic loss doctrine?
No, because it's a tort.
But you can't recover your contract. You can't recover contract-type damages.
Right.
In a tort of misrepresentation.
In Crookston, you recover tort damages. And those tort damages happen to comply or concur with some of the damage that would have been available under the contract.
What items of damage are you seeking?
Tort damages for the lost home. The value of this home was $269,000. as a result of the failure to pay and repair, the home was foreclosed upon. They lost $180,000 there. Emotional distress. The two had to go through a bankruptcy, for God's sakes. They lost all their other assets because of this foreclosure. Punitive damages. The summarily dismissal of this case after a 15-minute examination and pointing to pictures from 1993 creates an issue of punitive damages.
Let me go back to the first item. You want the value of the home?
Excuse me?
To go back to the first item, you want the value of the home.
Lost value of the home.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And is that limited by whatever it was insured for?
Nope. It's a tort damage. It's a tort damage approximately resulting from the bad faith denial and the inability of the Joneses to repair their home. It's important to recognize that all the cases cited by Secure for out-of-state cases were extra-contractual damages applied based on those courts recognizing that the tort of bad faith was a contractual claim. Extra-contractual damages like emotional distress are even allowed in those 10 to 12 cases cited by Secura that base bad faith claims on contract.
So you want loss of the home, you want punitive damages, and so what are you, what's the punitive damages? It's the wanton, reckless disregard?
Correct, Your Honor. What Secura did in this case is they denied the claim in 1997, pointed to their inspection report declaring the home a good risk in 1993, and said, wait a minute, all these problems existed at that point, failed to investigate what the actual cause of the damages were, and just said it was all pre-existing. So they took many years of premiums and then failed to recognize that they needed to pay out on the policy. Now remember, a bad faith claim is very difficult to prove. It would be extremely incredulous of the court to limit the amount of damages in a situation where we have a higher burden of proof. And it's incredulous to believe that just because in a negligence case where somebody's injured by an at-fault driver, that person is entitled to more damages than a person who is insured by a company, has a contract with that company, has a fiduciary relationship with the insurance company, but somehow they're not entitled to any damages. They have a special relationship. There's no special relationship between two tortfeasors in normal circumstances. That's the unique nature of this case. And if you look at DeChan and you look at Anderson, we constantly refer back to Grunberg. Now remember, in California, in the Grunberg decision, the court diverged from Wisconsin because they based bad faith on the contract. But initially, they started out that the tort, the duty, is independent. If
may
I may
finish your sentence, please.
This duty is independent of the contract and attaches over and above the terms of the contract. A tort may grow out of, or make a part of, or be coincident with a contract. The fact that there existed a contract between the plaintiffs and the defendant would not immune the latter, being the insurance company, from the penalty that is ordinarily visited upon tortfeasors. This is the founding principle of bad faith in Wisconsin under Anderson, and the court should continue to recognize it as such. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Falk. Thank you, Mr. Kobach. And that concludes our hearing on 00-3037 Jones versus Secure Insurance Company. The court is in recess until Monday, December 10th at 9:45, and it will continue its December calendar.